forward. The state of Michigan was pretty interesting, actually, because they did a sample recount of the most Democratic of all counties, that being Wayne County, which is where Detroit is. And they did discover evidence of voter fraud in those counties. They discovered faulty computer machines in those counties, which, by the way, voted overwhelmingly for Hillary Clinton. And they discovered cases where there was, it was suspected that the clerk involved, you know, put the ballot into the machine and it didn't quite register right, so they put it in again. In some cases, they put it in, you know, like a half a dozen times, maybe 8 to 10 times, until it finally clicked. But the fact is that all of those votes were counted. And it, the evidence led to the at least likelihood, the high likelihood, that if there was a voter discrepancy in Detroit, then it favored Hillary Clinton. Now, we might recall that in 2012, there were major discrepancies in Detroit, where Barack Obama, in some precincts in Detroit, and I think in several other big cities, including Cleveland, Philadelphia, St. Louis, that Barack Obama got like 98% of the vote, 99%, some cases 105%, you know, 110%. And that didn't look right. You know, I think it was Rush Limbaugh who said that even Stalin didn't get that high a vote. Didn't look good. So I think that what happened in Michigan was that when they saw this sort of evidence coming up, they realized, uh-oh, we better stop this, because otherwise there may be a major investigation that could go national and should go national in real voting problems in our state and in our city. And so they shut the whole thing down. So that's what happened in Michigan. Thus, the recounts didn't work. Meanwhile, Donald Trump came out with a statement that has been backed by some, there's no proof of it, that Hillary Clinton's huge lead in the popular vote might not be all it's cracked up to be, because in certain states, particularly he called out California, you had a situation where it was very likely that illegals voted. Now, illegals, illegal aliens, and that is the legal term for it here, they obviously can't vote in this election because they're not citizens. Only citizens legally can vote. And only citizens, I would add, should be legally allowed to vote. That's a good idea. I mean, do you want to be able to vote in an election in France? Or a Frenchman to come here and vote in our election? No, we want the election to reflect the American citizen. I mean, there is some value, and ought to be some value to citizenship. If there's any, it is the right to vote. And expect that your vote is not going to be diluted by a non-citizen who doesn't have a stake in the governing of this republic. And so the accusation was that hundreds of thousands, if not maybe even millions of people who are illegal aliens, cast a ballot. And that it is a fairly reasonable thing to suggest that they voted for Hillary Clinton. And so that possibly contributed to this huge imbalance in the vote. But there was a lot of agitation, starting really with the recounts, and one that continues. And this is kind of a sidebar to trying to overthrow Donald Trump, that is calling for the end of the Electoral College. And there are some pretty serious people who are weighing in on that. However, a major polling agency, I believe it was Gallup, just conducted a poll with regard to whether or not the American people support the Electoral College, which I should point out is a part of the Constitution. And I think it was over 50%. It's not an overwhelming number, but it's a number that actually has grown from 4 to 8 years ago. And so the American people do seem to understand the value of the Electoral College. So to try to agitate to overthrow the Electoral College is not something that's working out for the people who want to overthrow Donald Trump. And by the way, if you'd like to comment on that, you can join me. This is Chuck Morse here at 91.5 FM, WMFO, Medford. Come on down, 855-915-9636, 855-915-9636. Let me see if I can do a little PSA. Yep. I guess not. Okay. Well, wait a minute, let me just... Nope, cannot. I'm pretty new at this, so. So I still have to operate the old-fashioned way, which is fine as I learn the ropes. I just don't have the... I'm sticky on the hand, you know, on the buttons. I guess you might say. Let's see here. I'm looking at the PSA book. This is Riverdale Operations. Now this is something that I really should read because I do not know how to. I do not know how to operate Riverdale, which is the communication arm here. I also don't see, somebody maybe didn't put it away, but I don't see the PSA. Wait a minute, here it is. Let's see here. Okay. This is real old-fashioned radio. Know your cell phone rights. Whether you're taking your cell phone with you on a walk, in your car, or to a civil protest, you should know your legal rights. The U.S. Supreme Court unanimously ruled that police must obtain a warrant to search a person's cell phone. However, a phone without a passcode can readily be searched by anybody holding it. And a Virginia court recently ruled that a defendant can be compelled to unlock a device that's protected only by a fingerprint sensor. So consider using a key code password and setting your phone screen to look very quickly when no one is using it, particularly if you expect to be in a potentially volatile situation. While the police can't legally force you to unlock your phone, they can ask you to. And if you do that, you've forfeited your rights. The correct answer to a cop's request to search you, your vehicle, or your phone is, "No, officer, I do not consent to a search. Thank you." Finally, remember that the police can always ask a judge for a search warrant. To think carefully about what's stored on your phone, including photos, contacts, and app data. You can learn more about your rights from the Electronic Freedom Foundation on the web at EFF.org. This is a public service message from the EFF and your freedom-loving friends right here at WMFO in Medford, Tufts Educational Radio. Know your rights. Know your cell phone rights. Do not give up your cell phone records. I could not concur more heartily to that. So, back to the program here. Chuck Morse, come on down. Let's see. You can join me here at WMFO Studios. I'm live right up here in Medford at 855-915-9196. 3-6, thank you, I apologize. That number again is 855-915-9636. I'll be all right. You're welcome to join the program. What is on your mind this afternoon? So getting back to the topic of how they're going to try to destroy Trump. The recounts did not work. I just outlined why. So now they're trying to do something that, I mean, it's more sinister than anything that I have seen. They're trying to claim that Donald Trump was helped by the Russians, that Vladimir Putin hacked into the Hillary Clinton's emails to help Donald Trump and release them through WikiLeaks. And that Donald Trump and his campaign knew this was happening. Now, this is a very, very serious charge. I think this is one that would very well involve treason if it were true. I think that this is something that Donald Trump very well could be impeached for or should be asked to step aside for if it were true. So far, there's no evidence of it. First of all, Hillary Clinton during the campaign said that 17 intelligence agencies had claimed that the Russians were hacking into her email, or she made some vague reference to them helping Trump. Now, what's interesting to me about that, first of all, that was a lie. It was not 17 agencies. It's one agency, and that is the CIA. And even there, it is only three agents inside the CIA. Three operatives who are making this claim. We don't know their names. We don't know what the claims are. President Obama and CIA Director James Clapper could arrange for that information to be released, if not publicly, then at least to the electors who are meeting Monday to formally elect the president. So far, they haven't done that. You would think that they would do it if there was something there. After all, I mean, it's a partisan question, but they have chosen not to do it, at least not yet. Now, the Electoral College sits and votes Monday next week, so maybe something might happen between now and then, and maybe they will release the information. I have no idea if they have any information that's real. The director of the CIA, James Clapper, has said no. There's no evidence that Russia was trying to help Donald Trump, nor is there direct evidence that Russia actually committed this hack. So I think that probably the reason that they're not releasing it is because there's nothing there. I don't know that, though. Maybe there is. But until we find out, I think it's unfair to make that sort of speculation. And by the way, Donald Trump and his campaign have nothing to do with whether or not this information is released. That is completely the call of President Barack Obama and his CIA director, James Clapper. Now, what do I think about this? I think that it's highly unlikely that Vladimir Putin is trying to help Trump. If anything, I think Putin probably would prefer Hillary Clinton had won the election. The Russians have always operated, and this goes way back to the days of the Tsars, and even further back, probably the days of the Mongols. They tend to operate under the wire, and they tend to use blackmail as their primary means of promoting their own power. And I think that they felt that they could probably easily blackmail Hillary Clinton if she were elected, because they probably have a lot of stuff on her. Trump himself even made reference to this by wondering if the Russians had the 30,000 emails that she had deleted. Now, Trump says it was a joke. Other people said it was not a joke. Whether it was a joke or not, he said nothing wrong. He's just simply expressing exasperation that these emails have been deleted. But either way, Hillary Clinton's, as Secretary of State, she made a deal with an agency that is a Russian organization operating in Canada, by which she sold apparently a lot of American uranium to them. Now, that is a national security question. She had the power to do it, apparently, as Secretary of State, even though I wonder if she got the right clearance for that. That's something that ought to be investigated. But what apparently looks like a quid pro quo, shortly after that deal was made, by which the Russians gained access to American uranium, this same company made a huge contribution to the Clinton Foundation. Now, that seems to be how Hillary Clinton operated. And, of course, that's the height of corruption. I wonder if that's not the tip of the iceberg with regard to what information Putin and the Russians may have on the Clintons, and Hillary in particular, and how they may have used that information as blackmail had she been elected president. I think that they probably would have if they had it. Blackmail is nothing new. You know, it goes way back in politics, right? I mean, I know it seems like it's a fictional account of this, but I think it's one that illustrates what does happen. If you recall the Godfather movies, Godfather 2, remember the politician, I think he was a senator, and he's like threatening Michael Corleone, and he's very insulting, and he's, you know, I'm going to get you Italians and this kind of stuff. Well, I mean, they set him up so that he's there in a brothel, and they got pictures of him in bed with a hooker. So they bring him in, they're going, that's how Lyndon Johnson used to do business, right? You know, he'd call up a corporation, or he'd call up a president of a company, and he would bring him into the White House if he wanted something done, and he'd be like, USOB, you better do this, because I want it, and if you don't do it, I'm going to put you in jail. And then J. Edgar Hoover would suddenly walk in with a manila envelope, and he'd drop it surreptitiously on the coffee table, and out would pop pictures of this politician in bed with a hooker or some kind of financial impropriety information. And, of course, immediately there would be like, oh, yes, sir, what do you want? So, I mean, blackmail is nothing new. That's part of politics. So I would think that if Putin wanted to help anybody, it would be, it would be Hillary, not Trump, because Trump, he's kind of an independent. I don't think there's anything big on Trump. I would think, believe me, if there was, we'd know about it by now, because his enemies are high-level people who are really arrayed against him. The New York Times, the establishment, these are people who would have dug up something by now. And whatever they have on Trump, we kind of know about already. And it's conventional stuff, like his tape, his conversation that he had with Billy Bush. That's out there now. We know that. And it's bad, but it's not, he seems to have weathered it. It is what it is. It's damaging, but there it is. We all know that it was a private conversation. Or his bankruptcies, or his lawsuits. That's all out there. We all know about that. I think it would be helpful if he released his tax returns, but I think he'll probably do that after he's president, only because it's not that there's anything improprietous in there. It has more to do with the fact that it's going to be used by his enemies to try to embarrass him when they take a look at his deductions. Oh, you deducted $50,000 for champagne, or you deducted $100,000 for, you know, dancers at a private party, and blah, blah, blah. And it looks bad. You know, it looks stupid. It's not that he did anything illegal. He's entitled to those deductions. But it's personal. He doesn't want to have his personal life, you know, splayed across the newspapers, which gives a weapon to his enemies. He doesn't want to do that. So I think that has a lot more to do with why he didn't release his tax returns. But getting back to the subject of the Russian hacks, that is a serious matter. Rents Priebus, the head of the Republican National Committee, says that they were not hacked. And this is the claim made by the CIA, that they were both hacked, the Democratic Committee and the Republican. but the Republican stuff was not released. Priebus says they were not hacked. He says that he knows this only because after it came out that the Democrats were hacked, he contacted the FBI, asked them to come in and investigate to see if they'd been hacked, to put in security measures to make sure that they wouldn't be hacked. They came in, they investigated, they didn't find any evidence of hacking. They helped him further secure the email servers. And so he says they weren't hacked. As far as the Democrats go, apparently one of the reasons they were hacked was because John Podesta, the head of the Clinton campaign, he stupidly opened up an email, a spam email that was sent to him, and he entered his password. So, yeah, they were hacked. Now, Julian Assange says that it was not the Russians that gave him the information. Should we trust Julian Assange? I generally think, yes, we should. I think that he has been one of the most stand-up people to come down the pike in a decade. I mean, the work he's done to expose corruption all around the world is extremely interesting and courageous. I generally, I don't trust anyone 100%, but if he says that it was not the Russians, I think that that has to at least be given some weight. And one of the things that was said, the reason I bring this up is because Hillary Clinton revealed during the debates that there were 17 intelligence agencies that she claimed had said that the Russians had hacked, and which was turned out to be a lie. But putting that aside, I thought it was interesting that she revealed that we have 17 intelligence agencies, because this gets into the thesis of a book by Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy professor Michael J. Glennon. I interviewed Professor Glennon on my radio show a while back. He's right here at Tufts, and that is National Security and Double Government, in which Professor Glennon talks about, and he's been an advisor to the U.S. Senate. He's a pretty substantial guy when it comes to knowledge on these things. And he points out that this national security apparatus has become so big and so massive in its power that it's virtually formed what he calls a double government, right? It's been in place since it was established in 1948 by executive order by President Harry S. Truman, when he consolidated what had been the OSS during the Second World War into the CIA. He created the DS, the National Security Council, which would be a direct advisory to the executive. And he created the NSA, the National Security Agency, which is this huge and amorphous intelligence gathering group that was exposed by Edward Snowden as having an apparatus that could look at practically every stroke of your computer and listen in and eavesdrop on your cell phone calls, right? And by the way, Barack Obama expanded that when he became president by adding to the USA Patriot Act and allowing more surveillance of cell phone calls. So we have in place this national security outfit that's huge, that has its tentacles in all branches of government, including the Supreme Court. I mean, Michael Glennon says that that Antonin Scalia and one other justice, I think it was Alito, I'm not sure, had both been part of this national security apparatus. They have representatives in Congress. They have people in the executive. They've got people in all these alphabet agencies that are a part of the executive branch. And so I think that by Hillary Clinton identifying that, it kind of revealed the level of that. And of course, Donald Trump has been critical of that, which to me, makes him, again, a revolutionary leader, a revolutionary president. So this is a serious charge. I don't know anything more about it than anyone else, whether or not Trump actually coordinated with the Ruskies, as Jeb Bush said recently, to affect the election. I don't know if he did or not, but if he did, that's very bad news. Maybe that really would be a death blow to Trump in terms of his holding that office. I don't know. Wouldn't be the first time that a foreign power had intervened in an American election, but that's beside the point. I mean, we saw recently that there was a revelation that Ted Kennedy actually sent an envoy to Moscow to try to undo Jimmy Carter in the primary of 1980, that being John Tunney, his good friend and former senator from California. So, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if that was the case. We don't know. I mean, I don't really know what to say about it. I think that we'll hopefully find out. I doubt it, frankly. But there it is. I mean, it's, you know, I think this is just another dirty trick. And I think that once it's over and once we do find out that this was not the case, and once hopefully Monday when the electors elect formally Donald Trump, which, by the way, I would not take for granted, given what he's up against, then we shall see what happens from there. I don't know. It's a nail biter, and obviously, once that happens, we'll have to see what their next agenda is in terms of trying to undermine Trump. Because I don't think they're going to stop. I think this is going to continue right through his presidency and beyond. Again, because Trump is waking America up. He's waking up the masses that we're going to put America first. And that is why they despise and fear Donald J. Trump. Anyway, you're welcome to join me, Chuck Morse, WMFO, Medford. 855-915-9636 is the number. 855-915-9636. Come on down, Tufts University students. What's on your mind this afternoon? Obviously, if you call in the program, you are anonymous, so don't worry about it. I don't need to put up a cone of silence. You don't even need to give your name, of course. But you're welcome aboard. There's a video making the rounds from Great Britain of a protest in London. 1,000 Muslims block London streets chanting Allah Akbar. Well, that's nice. It says here more than 1,000 Muslims took to the streets of London last night, that being yesterday, chanting Allah Akbar and demanding an Islamic caliphate. And this is on YouTube, by the way. A poet invited to talk shouted, "We need a caliph." Let me just see. My computer is jumping around here. There's a lot of video on this. Here we go. "We need a caliph," he says. "The street outside is empty, outside the empty embassy in Belgrave Square, London, was closed off and filled with protesters and Islamic leaders chanting loudly and calling for America to be punished over Aleppo." Why should America be punished over Aleppo exactly? I mean, it's not Americans that are there slaughtering innocent men and women and children. It's not Americans beheading people and burning churches with women in them, right? I don't think it's Americans who are doing that. Why should we be punished? I think it's devout, fundamentalist Muslims who are doing it. Okay. The demonstration became an alternative to the official rally calling for an end to the bloodshed in Syria outside Downing Street. Now, like a lot of things, these things start out with well-intended people, right? I mean, I think that we all want to see the bloodshed stop in Aleppo. I think that's something that the world wants to see stopped. And I think that probably at least some, if not most, of the people that went to this rally were well-intended. They did not want to, they weren't there to support ISIS. Yeah, they were there because they want to see peace. They want to see the killing stopped. But you have to pay attention to the organizers and the people who used this rally, like any rally. The demonstration became, and I'm back to the article here. The demonstration became an alternative to an official rally calling for an end to the bloodshed in Syria. During the speeches, which lasted almost an hour, the crowd chanted Allah Akbar, God is the greatest, and cheered those calling for a global caliphate. Now, I'm sorry, but I told people this. You know, people say, oh, well, we have to have Muslims in the government in London, and we have to have them come to the country because that's being inclusive. And I think that the majority of Muslims are people who want to escape from, frankly, their own faith and become westernized. In fact, it's interesting. There's a sub-movement in Europe right now. I read an article about this last weekend in an English newspaper where increasing numbers of Muslims are converting to Christianity. They're showing up and being converted to Catholicism, to Lutheranism. And they genuinely are leaving, in the real sense, these miserable societies that they fled from. I applaud that, frankly. I also have no problem with secularized Muslims who want to accept, frankly, and I'm sorry to put it this way, I don't know how else to say it, but a more Christianized vision of Islam, one that holds that jihad is nothing more than a desire to improve your own life and your own world through love and through peace and through a kind of an acceptance of a God of the a creator of the universe. It's a more Christian approach, quite frankly. But that's not what's being talked about on the streets of London right now, and no one should be surprised that they want to create a world caliphate. In other words, they want to physically conquer the entire planet and subdue it to fundamental Islam. I mean, that was the command of the founder of their faith, Muhammad, who was more than just a religious leader. He was obviously a political and military leader who wanted to conquer all of Arabia and the world, ultimately. I mean, I think the idea there, frankly, is that if there is one God in heaven, then there literally has to be one government on earth to reflect that God. An idea that, by the way, completely contradicts the Torah and the teachings of the Torah, which hold that there are many nations of the world, and that's a natural system of checks and balances. Anyway, getting back to what's going on in London today with people calling for the overthrow of the government, basically, on the street. Backhand your missiles. Back to your land. That's the plan. With domination at hand. Woo, they like the way they rhyme, huh? We can expect and take out these fools. The crowd largely segregated into men and women, with many of the women wearing Islamic clothing. According to Breitbart, which, by the way, has a political office in London, so they have reporters there on the ground, one protester appeared to be waving a Taliban flag while others were handed placards made by Hizb al-Tahrir, Britain, which calls for the reestablishment of a caliphate. It is unclear who organized the demonstration. Breitbart also reported that Hitham al-Haddad, a Saudi-trained Salafist Muslim, congratulated the crowd on amassing so quickly and in such large numbers, saying, quote, "The gathering today, in a matter of a few hours, hundreds of brothers and sisters coming together, it is a sign, positively, and revival, and a sign of victory for Allah." Most speakers kept to the message over foreign action in Syria. So you have, in this, religious Muslims who are seeking the world order. I would suggest that that while they come at this from different angles, and while they may appear different in terms of cosmetic appearance, the radical Islamic movement is similar to the radical left in the West, in that they are all agitating for not a political revolution to break out around the world, but a social revolution. There's a difference. The American Revolution was a political revolution. We sought politically to establish our independence, to reestablish our rights, rights that had been usurped by the British crown. The French Revolution, on the other hand, and the Russian Revolution, and the Islamic Revolution, these are our social revolutions. They seek to establish a new social order. They don't seek to reestablish rights. They seek to change rights. And the only way to do such a change, if such a thing were good, and it's not, it's evil, is to change human nature, which is exactly what they try to do. And the only way to do that, whether or not, regardless of their protestations otherwise, is by use of force and by the elimination of those who stand in the way of the utopian experiment. I mean, it's kind of like, if you looked at it from a scientific standpoint, in order to conduct a perfect scientific experiment, a biological experiment, you have to have a completely cleaned atmosphere, you know, in a test tube or in a petri dish, where nothing else is going on, so that you can look at something in its purity and understand it. Well, in order to have the leftist or Islamist social experiment, you have to have the same. You have to remove the impurities, as they might call them, people who are not politically correct. And that means, of course, a Holocaust in some cases, or a genocide, or, you know, the complete slaughter of anyone who stands in the way of their idea of progress. And they believe, and I think they genuinely believe, that they are conducting that agenda for good reasons. I don't doubt that. I think Hitler believed he was good. The Nazis believed that they were moral when they conducted the Holocaust. And so when they try to implement their caliphate, one world government, they find resonance with the radical left, for sure, openly, who supports them. It's their main supporter around the world. But I would even say tacitly by the less conscious left, people who are not necessarily aware of what they've embraced, but people who have done so because of social reasons, social pressures, I don't want to say brainwashing, but conditioning, let's put it that way, but who also believe in the ultimate virtue of this sort of world order where everything changes in a certain direction. For the left, that means equality de facto. There's no such thing as the institutions that stand in the way of equality, which they believe are false and are part of a conspiracy to exploit people, need to be annihilated. You can look at Marx's writing on this. And that includes property, family, love, private institutions, free trade in goods and services, limited government, belief in God, faith. All these things need to be abolished to create this total equality. Islam is very similar, believe me. Islam believes in a one world completely submitted to this very distant and very inchoate view of God. Now, I would suggest that in this regard, Islam is actually better than the socialistic experiments that manifested themselves in the form of communism and Nazism. Because at least Islam does believe in God. The socialist movement does not. So as long as they do believe in God, however watered down that belief is, and I do think their belief is quite watered down, there's no set standard of moral or ethical code connected to it, which is the case with both Judaism and Christianity. But at least as long as they believe in a divine creator of the universe who is outside of human manipulation, then there is hope that they might be able to reform themselves, that they might be able to, you know, there is hope for them. And I think that there have been, over the centuries, moderate Muslim movements and regimes who are not interested in the physical conquest of the planet, the sublimation of all of mankind to their rule. And I think that that restraining aspect is as a result of their belief in God, whereas there is no such constraint amongst the communists and the Nazis and the international supporters that have always financed them. They reject God. They believe that man is God. They believe that Christ is a person that's in everyone. We're all our own Christs. If you take a look at their writing, you can see this. And that that we need to reform and change human nature on earth by the rule of an elite. What Jean-Jacques Rousseau called the philosopher kings. That will, and by the way, his ideas directly contributed to the Reign of Terror in France, the world's first modern communist revolution. And so they find common cause. And so they advocate that Muslims be welcomed into Europe because they know that Christianity in Europe has waned after centuries of so-called enlightenment and the sort of the breaking of the barricade of the faith. Now they even have a pope that seems to be part of this, frankly. And that Islam can come in and pick up the slack. That to have an openly Nazi-like movement or a right-wing, well, by right-wing I mean, you know, actually left-wing, I should say, Nazi or communist movement, That might happen as a reaction. In fact, it already seems to be happening in Europe as a reaction to the Islamists. And thus Europe will become engulfed in a civil war between two sides that are both authoritarian and that are both anathema to genuine progress that is manifested in the rise of the individual. And that this serves their purpose. This is what World War I did. I mean, it created these behemoth-grown super-states, these socialistic, massive states that engaged in international, you know, colonization, which is something that I do not support, and the subjugation of peoples all over the world, that they came into this massive clash with the idea that out from that would emerge an even more powerful system of totalitarian control. And in fact, they succeeded partially. And eventually, more so, in that directly from World War One came Bolshevik Russia and eventually Nazi Germany, both of which were leftist totalitarian experiments. And so I think the dynamic now is, again, let in the Muslims, let them have their radical movement toward a caliphate, and then let homegrown Europeans react by moving to the right, so to speak, even though, again, I would suggest it's to the left, and create a more authoritarian reaction, and you'll have a civil war. Is that what Europe wants? Is that what we want in this country? Do we think we're immune from that? Take a look at the, you know, this is what Trump wants to avoid by reducing immigration from people who do not share our values, who do not share our culture. Is it standing up for our values to let people come into the country who don't share those values? And then we're told, oh, well, we have something against Muslim men and women. Not at all. I have nothing but sympathy for Muslim men and women and the terrible oppression, especially women, that they have to live under, this delusion that they have to accept second-class citizenship, that they have to accept a status by which they're literally owned by their husbands like they're pieces of property, that they can't go out of the house if they're not married unless they're in the accompaniment of an approved man, whether it be their father or their brother, or else they'll be slaughtered. No, I don't accept that. I don't know why people do accept it unless they're unconscious. But they do. It's like a massive hypnosis, quite frankly. I don't know how else to explain it. And I'd also say that about some of these left-wingers who are so twisted and so, like, writhing in paroxysms of rage over the election of Donald Trump. Might they ask themselves exactly what it is they're so angry about? I mean, I can speak to this. I have members of my own family that are going through this. You can't talk to them. These are people who will not speak to me possibly ever again. In which case, I don't know, maybe it's all too soon. But their entire world has been pulled out from under them, it seems. And I don't think they really understand why. You know, they talk about Donald Trump as being a racist. They really think that Donald Trump has something against black men and women. Do they really believe that? I think if you want to see real racism, you take a look at the legacy of Barack Obama. That's racism. I mean, Barack Obama was elected and proudly, partially, because he happens to be black. Let's face it. Let's admit that. If he wasn't black, he would have been what he was, which was a local community organizer in Chicago, who became like a state legislator, sort of like teeny tiny Timmy Toomey in Somerville. Can you imagine electing Timmy Tiny teeny Toomey to presidency? Well, that's what happened with Barack Obama, and it's because he was black. Okay, fine. I think the vast majority of Americans were hopeful that having the first openly black president would lead to at least the beginnings of a post-racial era. I think most Americans wanted that, even if we didn't agree with Barack Obama in his politics, even if we didn't vote for Barack Obama. I do believe that the vast majority of Americans wanted that. In fact, Gallup did a poll right after the election of 2008 indicating just that. About 75% of Americans, which is a very high number, were hoping that we would enter into a post-racial era. So that idea was very popular. And yet, I think that it's fair to say that Barack Obama squandered that opportunity. He squandered it because he was more loyal to his left-wing ideas that he probably had imbibed as a young man than he was to the interests of America, frankly. I'm sorry to put it that way, but that does appear to be the case. And by embracing those ideas, he was promulgating a system that, frankly, can only be described as racist. Does that make him a conscious racist? No. But the ideas that he embraced have caused racial division and suffering in this country. We already have racism. Let's face that. I mean, that's not even, you know, I mean, controversial. We know this. We're a multiracial society, one of the most multiracial in history. And so, yeah, there are tensions between the races and between ethnic groups. That's just, you know, it's a darker side of human nature, I guess. You know, it's not good, but unfortunately, that's the way it is. I mean, we're tribal, okay? So, yeah, there's always going to be a certain amount of heightened race consciousness in a free society where you have many races, right? I mean, this isn't like, you know, a one-race place here. But Barack Obama exacerbated the problem by continuing to embrace racist policies. And I'm going to give you a few examples. And they're leftist policies, by the way. By the early 1960s, African Americans in this country were emerging into the middle class, into the upper middle class in some cases. Their families were intact. Their education level was high. Their entrepreneurial level was high. They were beginning to seriously assimilate into this country in the same way that any other ethnic group assimilates. They were on the verge of it, I would argue, because of their rising success. And this was in spite of real racism, Jim Crow laws, open discrimination, you know, the kind of racism that, I mean, it's unbelievable to think about this today because most of us aren't old enough to remember it, but I'll give you an example. Ralph Bunche, he was Dwight Eisenhower's UN ambassador, happened to be black. One of the most distinguished diplomats of the post-war period. He personally brokered a peace agreement between Israel and Syria in 1949. Can you imagine that? That's no easy feat. I mean, this was a great and distinguished man. When he was entertaining a diplomat in Washington, he couldn't go to certain restaurants because he was black. I mean, this is how bad Jim Crow and formal discrimination was, right? I mean, it's hard to imagine, you know, that system and that it even existed in this country, but it did. And I would say especially south of the Mason-Dixon line, but it even existed in the North, let's face it. And yet, in spite of that, black people were emerging and would have continued to emerge, especially after the passage of the Civil Rights Act in 1965, which was always a Republican idea, by the way. But instead, the left came up with this federalization of welfare. At a time when America was moving into greater prosperity for all Americans, this was the 60s, we should note, economically, were a boom time. But instead, you had Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, followed by Nixon sending block grants to groups like ACORN and other radical groups that went out of their way to get people on welfare. They were anti-business. They sought to expand welfare to the point where today, in many cases, a person on welfare receives a lot more financial benefits than the working poor. And so they got an entire generation, particularly of black people, hooked on welfare. Now people will say, oh, well, there were more white people on welfare than black. Yeah, that's true. But if you look at the ratio in the population, of the percentage of population that's black versus white, then that figure becomes, focuses in a little bit more what it really is. And so with black people going on welfare, you had women who were being essentially given financial incentives to get rid of their husbands, and then more financial incentives for having children out of wedlock. Now, I think some of that's changed, but the result was that you had a generation of a breakdown of the black family. You had young black men in particular growing up in a household without the benefit of having a father, a male role model. You had left-wing attitudes against business that discouraged entrepreneurialism with high taxes and onerous regulation and an attitude of disgust for a business as being somehow a white idea. You had a destruction of the education system by replacing phonics, which is how to read, with look-say reading. And you had, you know, the destruction of the black church, which is a big assignment. I'm reaching the end of the program. I don't have time to get into that. But the result was that these racist programs caused, you know, ills, social ills among the black community. Not to mention the communist-inspired riots of the 1960s, which burned down black neighborhoods and looted them to the point where many of them never recovered or took a generation to recover them. And so we have all of that, and we have a rise in crime and drug use and murder in these communities because there's nowhere to go. These young men have no father figure. They've got no job potential. They've had this lousy education. They've had a destruction of their church. And so many of them turn to crime. And the response by the establishment is to not do anything about it. Let the criminals go. You have left-wing judges letting them out easy. You know, you've got this cottage industry that's a multi-billion-dollar industry, mainly staffed by leftists, trying to address these problems that they caused. And then you have Barack Obama come along and attack and denigrate the one group of people that is left, that actually cares about the black community, and that is the police. People who are trying to risk their lives to go in and enforce the law and protect the 98% of the community that's trying to get on with their life, trying to get to work, from thugs. They're attacked by Barack Obama. They're second-guessed. Now, I'm not here to say every policeman's perfect, but for the most part, this has led me to respect what they do a lot more. And so Barack Obama, rather than take an opportunity to enhance and improve race relations by improving the condition of the black community, by getting rid of some of these racist left-wing programs and ideas, instead he put those interests first. And so you have a further division of the races under his watch. I think there's hope today with Donald Trump. You just watch. Anyway, we're reaching the end of the program. This is Chuck Morse. You can get my books online at Amazon.com. Just put my name in the server, Chuck Morse, M-O-R-S-E, like Morse code. And you shall see my books come up. There are many of them. I have a new one that hopefully will be coming out soon. And I guess I want to thank you all for listening this afternoon. I'm going to try to figure out how to, since there's no one here to take the show, I'm going to see if I can figure out how to turn things over to Rivendell. Anyway, thank you so much, everybody, for listening this afternoon. And let's see if I can get some kind of music going here. Here we go.